In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, I'm going to be talking to Wade Foster about how they support over 700 services with Zapier. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 327. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Wade.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Wade?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Awesome. So it's great to have you on. I wanted to give a very brief intro to you and tell people a little bit about who you are. You're one of the co-founders of Zapier. Zapier is essentially the glue that holds together a lot of different applications and passes data back and forth between them. But I guess with that said, I'll turn it over to you because you're probably going to rephrase that much better than I possibly could.
Oh, yeah. The old what does Zapier do question, right? Glue is a good word. Connector integrations is a good word. Honestly, it's just this workflow automation platform that lets you hook up basically any app you might be using in your business. So, you know, a simple use case might be I get an email and it has an attachment. You can set up a little rule in Zapier that automatically saves those attachments to Dropbox. You know, something more sophisticated might be someone fills out a lead form on my site that's maybe powered by a tool like, say, Unbounce, and it pushes it through like a tool like Clearbit that grabs a bunch of social data for it. Then based on some conditions, it maybe decides, hey, I'm going to send this into my CRM and have a salesperson follow up with it. Or maybe I'll send it into a tool like Rob's Drip and say like, hey, let's nurture this user, something like that. So it can do a lot more sophisticated things as well.
But it's all about automating kind of workflows in a business process. And you really don't necessarily see the product itself. You see all the results of it, though. It's always working in the background for you.
Yeah, exactly. Zapier is an invisible product in the sense of when it's running. You set up the rules in Zapier. So there's a UI for you know, setting up the rules and how data should flow from app to app. But once you have that set up, Zapier just cranks away. So if you're technical, it's kind of like a cron job, more or less, but on steroids.
Cool. So why don't you give us a bit of a brief history of Zapier? Kind of when did you start on it? How long did it take before you went from this whole idea of having it to going through a little bit about the validation process and then actually launching it as a product?
Yeah. So we started Zapier in late 2011. And so I guess a little before that, Brian and I, who's one of my co-founders, had been doing, you know, a decent amount of freelancing, messing around with various projects. And one of the things that came up a handful of times was these like little integration projects. So, you know, push these PayPal sales into QuickBooks for me or push this set of leads into Salesforce for me, stuff like that. And, you know, it was kind of annoying work to do because no one particularly likes doing API work, it seems, but it was really valuable for these customers. And so Brian messaged me on chat and said, you know, I think we can build a tool that lets these business owners or non-technical kind of use case users, you know, set up these sorts of integrations without having to employ a developer or an engineer. And, you know, I found myself nodding my head saying like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so we actually teamed up with Mike, who's our third co-founder, and built out the original kind of version of Zapier at a hackathon, a startup weekend, if you've ever heard of those. And things went really well, and we're like, hey, let's really give this a go because this seems like something that folks could use. And so we were back in Columbia, Missouri at the time, and we decided, hey, we can't go at this full time because we need to have money and things like that. You don't just raise a bunch of money in the Midwest, typically. So we kept our day jobs. Mike was still in school, kept finishing up school. We worked on this nights and weekends. And, you know, we tried to find ways that we could figure out if people wanted this. The best ways for that were looking into user forums. So I distinctly remember HiRise, the CRM, having a thread that was several years old asking for Google Contacts integration and had hundreds of comments on it where people wanted this thing. So we'd go find for little bitty signs like that that showed, hey, if we could build something like this, people would be interested. And so that's really kind of how Zapier got its start.
Cool. So one of the things that I'll just kind of point out is it's pronounced Zapier, not Zapier, right?
Yep. Zapier makes you happier is the trick we always share with folks.
Oh, nice. That's a good way to remember it and kind of let people know that's how to pronounce it. Because I've honestly mispronounced it for years.
Yep. We've heard Zapier, Zapier, Zapier. Yeah, we've heard every pronunciation under the sun.
Cool. So that was back in 2011, and you know, fast forward 6 years. And how many apps are you managing right now, like in terms of the integrations?
Sure. So there's 750 plus, I think 788 is the exact number. It changes daily. And yeah, there's a lot.
So how are you actually managing those? I mean, are you responsible for every single one of those? Or is it really the developers behind the applications that are responsible for them?
So the vast majority are built and maintained by the vendors behind these companies. So you look at companies like Slack or HubSpot or Gravity Forms or Pipedrive or Drip. Those vendors have built and maintain their integrations on Zapier. Now we do a lot of work to help and assist with that because ultimately, you know, Zapier is our service. So like we feel responsible for the quality of those integrations. But these days, that's how it happens. Originally, we did build out like the original 50 or 60 or so apps. But once we launched our developer platform, we started to kind of, you know, expand the universe of people who could add apps to Zapier.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point to bring up, just because when I was looking at Zapier and trying to think about how I could integrate Bluetick in it, my initial thought was that I had to approach you guys and convince you that, hey, you should build an integration for Bluetick into this so that then it would be available through your platform. And you're saying you've got this developer platform that allows the developers themselves to just build something, right?
Exactly, yeah. You know, early on, we realized we were getting so many requests to add services to Zapier, and we just realized like there's just no way we'll be able to keep up with the demand for this, because we would have so many developers saying, hey, build my app, build my app, build my app. And as much as we would want to do that, like that was just not going to be possible for us. And so we're like, well, we need to build a way that lets them do it themselves because the interest is so strong. And so in 2012, we launched V1 of our developer platform to kind of kickstart that process.
Yeah. So this developer platform, can you tell me a little bit more about what the process is for a developer who has an app and maybe they want to get it integrated into Zapier so that people who are using Zapier can send data back and forth between Zapier and that app and the other applications that you guys support? What's the process for somebody getting started with that?
So it's relatively straightforward. It's self-serve. So you go to zapier.com/developer and you can basically just start building against it. We have like an API that we kind of call a standard, I guess, for lack of a better word. So if it fits like those types of standards, it's going to be super easy to set up because we kind of automatically configure a lot of this stuff for you, right? So if you kind of do like authentication by OAuth2 by the book, more or less, like we kind of auto set that up for you. You know, if your endpoints are REST-based JSON endpoints that can sort by descending order chronologically, like you're going to basically be able to just plug stuff into Zapier and it's just going to work. However, lots of services don't have those things kind of set up in what we would call the standard way, I guess, more or less. I say standard because there's lots of ways to do this stuff.
Let's call it guidelines.
Guidelines, yeah. That's,
recommended guidelines.
Yeah, right.
And it's not
that's not a problem, right? So we have this whole scripting environment where you can manipulate the requests to kind of match our recommended guidelines, if you will.
Yeah, and the two things that I kind of came across when I was doing the integration with Bluetick and Zapier was that one is like I didn't realize how easy it was to get started. I mean, if you have a Zapier account, you just go into the developer platform and you can just create a Zap, and there's I didn't realize this, but there were three different ways that you can build it. You can build it as private, so it's just you that can see it. And so essentially what that means is if somebody doesn't have a Zapier integration, you can almost create it for them and then just not share it. You can kind of keep it to yourself. And then there's the invite only, which is kind of where you would probably use it to invite some of your beta customers. And then there's the global. And it's interesting, there's that progression there. But you could build your own Zapier integration for somebody else's product, technically.
Yeah, you totally can. People use that private state for like hobby projects and, you know, small little things all the time. That invite only stage gets used by slightly bigger companies to hook in apps that are like their own internal tools, more or less, and invite like their own employers or teammates in to use them with no intentions of ever having a public app on Zapier. So you can have like apps in any of these stages, you know, or intend to have an app in any of these stages at Zapier.
And you essentially make sure that when people are pushing out new versions of it, that they're not breaking existing functionality, right?
Yeah. So we have this whole process, one for, you know, when you want a public app, it goes through a review and things like that. I think that was one of the lessons we learned early on, is that, you know, we would push out apps just because we wanted to move that number of apps supported count up. And we would probably skimp on, you know, like a QA quality check sort of thing. But we realized over time that's not helping anybody, right? It's helping our ego maybe, but the end user might suffer for that. So, you know, we push folks through a quality check. And then when migrations or changes are made to apps that are live, there's like a whole migration process to mitigate some of those breaking changes for folks who are relying on it.
Now, how long does it take for somebody to go through that process? So let's say that they've got an initial version out there integrated into Zapier's developer platform, and they want to push it live. Like, is there additional manual buttons that need to be pushed, or is it all more or less automated?
It really depends, right? So if you kind of have an API that already fits those guidelines that match us, you can physically do this like really, really quickly. We actually have a video of our CTO adding Etsy in like under 6 minutes because our API kind of fits those guidelines that we have. So you can actually do the integration super quickly if you're familiar with it. And then if you're not familiar, you have to read some docs and figure some of that stuff out, which can take a little bit of time. And then, of course, I mentioned the QA process. So that you nail it, the style guide, like right out the gate, pay attention to all the kind of rules and configurations that we suggest. You know, you can kind of nail it the first time around, and that might take 24 to 48 hours for someone to go through the review Q&A process. If you're not matching those guidelines, you might be a little bit of work, right? It could maybe take a couple days of like people time, if that's like the only thing you're focusing on, to maybe get that ironed out. I know, Mike, you just went through one, so maybe you can comment for you on what your experience was.
My experience was probably more painful. Well, I mean, I think you're right in terms of the people time, but the reality is like, it's not like that was my sole focus. There's lots of other things that I was doing and working on, and changing, like with my product, the entire product is built on this, on my API. So in order to make it work with Zapier, it was actually much more painful because if I made any changes to the API, then I had to go into my client code and change all that code. And then I had to go to Zapier. So it was actually significantly more painful. And the kind of workaround I ended up coming up with was I just created a custom Zapier endpoint, and anything that needs to be done, I just send it to there, and then I'm not affecting my client-side code inside of the app.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's a consideration lots of apps will have if they already have users relying on a particular endpoint and, you know, it doesn't match kind of our API guidelines. Well, something's got to give right there. I think your solution is actually a pretty common one that folks adopt, is to say like, well, this is the way it kind of needs to be done for Zapier, so let's make an endpoint for that.
Cool. So moving on a little bit from kind of the technical aspects of it, you went from 0 to 1.5 million users in 5 years. What made that possible?
Well, I think this is the magic of having 700 plus apps on Zapier, honestly. You know, every new app that we would add to Zapier, or, you know, later on that somebody else would add to Zapier later on, was a new user base that we could tap into. And so really early on, we started developing kind of a playbook for doing marketing alongside of our partners. And so every time a new app is launched on Zapier, we're trying to get an announcement in like their monthly newsletter or their feature launch newsletter. We're trying to get listed in their integrations directories. We're making sure that, you know, their onboarding email sequence, when they send out like the advanced tips email, that Zapier is included there. So we're doing all sorts of things with them to try and continually just tap into their user base. You know, we spin up landing pages for all the potential integrations that could possibly exist so we can start driving search traffic to it. So, you know, just lots of different ways that we can just try and tap into this existing user base that already exists and get those to us. And so that's really been the bread and butter for us. And then It's 5 years of work, right? Like, you just kind of make progress every single day and push yourself to be a little bit better each day, and kind of compounds upon itself.
Yeah, it sounds to me like the couple of different things that you had going for you was, one, I guess from external to Zapier, we call it integration marketing, but it's really integrating into other apps. And kind of honestly, Zapier is one of the big ones that is pushed because of you have such a large user base, and there's all these other apps that you're essentially cross-promoting them, your app between them, because it gives you that viral component. And that sort of plays into it as well, because you're in the middle, so you get the benefit of both of those things.
Yeah, totally. You can leverage the fact that we have a big user base to reach to our user base. Like, we launched that to an email list of 1 million plus. Plus, if you're creative, you can go to the apps that are on Zapier and say, like, hey, we now have an integration through Zapier. Let's do some marketing around this.
You know, what's interesting is I've actually used, and I don't know if you've heard this before, but I've used Zapier as essentially a search engine to find solutions to problems.
Yeah, that's more or less what's happening more and more these days. Like, our app directory has, you know, tons of stuff. We have a lot of content around the best apps for certain categories of things. So people more and more kind of look at Zapier and say, like, hey, if they're on Zapier and they're probably a pretty good app, right? It probably means they're like, they're open, they play well with others. Like, there's some other nice signals that they're getting from our directory.
So one of the things that you talked about very early on was the fact that you had been working with different customers to try and do integrations from your previous company where you were just doing web development for people. What were some of the earliest things that you found that got you some initial traction with Zapier?
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned the forums earlier, and that was probably the best thing for getting like a handful of folks. So that high-rise forum that had, you know, hundreds of comments, there was, I remember one on Evernote, and I remember one on Dropbox. I remember one on Salesforce as well that had these forums where people would ask for it. And I would drop into these forums and say, hey, you know, I'm working on a project where I might be able to solve this for you. If you're interested, you know, get in touch here. And I would drop a link back to Zapier in a contact form. And a decent chunk of people would say, hey, this is what I've been looking for. You know, it doesn't look like I'm going to get official support for a native integration. So this seems like the next best bet. And we would get like a decent chunk of folks coming in that way. One link in a forum might drive 10 site visitors, and five of them would fill out that form. And so early on, that was just perfect for us because it's just the right amount of people we needed to kind of test our assumptions, build out the initial apps we needed on Zapier.
Now, that sounds like an extremely high ratio of people who visited and filled that out. I mean, you've got 10 visitors, which does not sound like a lot. I mean, most people would look and say, oh, well, I really want to get 100 or 1,000 or 5,000. But you're saying that 10 was what really did it for you. I mean, that's all it took.
Yeah. So for us, I think it was, you know, those forum posts were so, like, if you go back, I don't even know if you could find them anymore. A lot of people nuked their forums. But the comments in there were just like so visceral to these people. It's like, I need this integration so bad. It was so needed for them. They took time to write on a forum about it, right? And so just the fact that we were offering that, I think people were like, oh my God, there's a way I can get this. So they went through, clicked through, and it's like, if it seemed like it was going to solve their problem, then they were more than happy to give it a try. And so I think that's why the conversion rates on those 10 visits were so high. It was just like, this is a thing I've already raised my hand and said, I'm begging for this. I need this really bad.
Right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that they saw your explanation in the forum and then they clicked the link and now they're at a page where they've almost already raised their hand and said, yes, I'm interested in this. And then you put it right in front of them and say, here's a form to fill out to contact us and then we'll talk. So they're already interested. They're kind of past that point. So that's kind of an interesting data point.
Yeah. It's like, you know, people who are like, I want some Girl Scout cookies. And we just walked up and said, hey, we got some. You want to buy them? And they're like, yes, please.
Yes, I'll take 400 boxes of Thin Mints.
Yeah, more or less.
So obviously, it sounds like that one worked out for you really well. What are some other kind of marketing techniques that you tried that just completely bombed? I mean, I think that's an interesting conversation.
So good question. I think later on, as we got bigger, we started experimenting with kind of some of the different tactics you hear. And one of the ones that we tried was running joint webinars with a lot of our partners. And this one was one we really struggled to make super effective for us. And I think it might be because we have like this freemium, low cost sort of thing. And webinars took a lot of time and effort to put a nice one together and to get enough people on them. And so maybe that's why it didn't work. But ultimately, we would do these things and we might get like a decent chunk of folks to show up. Like, we'd get 200 or 300 folks to register and maybe half of that would show up. But a lot of them would already be like signed up to Zapier. So it wasn't helping us get new users. We were hoping that the partners, the app that it was in mind would promote this more heavily to their user base. But a lot of times they would just talk about it on their blog or on Twitter or something like that, which didn't ultimately drive much traffic to it. And so I think it was just a lot of time and work for relatively low amounts of people coming to us. And we were just hoping to get it scaled out more. So I think we, you know, when we were really doing it, we still do some of these, mostly just to like kind of make partners happy, some of our bigger partners happy. But when we were really trying to do it, like we did maybe a dozen of them, and we really maybe only had one that was any meaningful result for us.
Yeah, it sounds to me like if the intent was to help out the partners who are integrating into your app, then that would have been beneficial for them, but not necessarily for you, because most of the people who are attending are already users of Zapier. It doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah, it was like, you know, these people, maybe they're looking for, you know, some extra use cases for Zapier, or, you know, but that's kind of stuff we could have solved with an email, right? And said like, hey, here's like 10 use cases with this particular app. Go try these out. They're probably pretty good. And you don't have to take time to put on like a real-time event sort of thing.
Right. Cool. One of the things that kind of comes to mind is that Zapier is primarily a remote company, correct?
Yeah. Yep. 100%.
So last week's episode, Rob and I talked about some of the pros and cons of a local versus a remote team. And Rob also talked about kind of a hybrid approach that he used with building Drip. What's some of the biggest challenges that you've found with running a remote team? You've got, what, around 70 employees right now?
Yep. I think the biggest challenge is it really forces you to be more disciplined around communication and information sharing. So, you know, you think for us, we hire all around the world as well. So we're in about a dozen time zones. So right now I have teammates that are sleeping or not working, right? And so if I'm doing work that is going to affect them, I have to make sure to document that either in code, like in GitHub, or it needs to be in Trello or Quip or somewhere, right? That they can take advantage of it. So when they come in and start to pitch in on the projects I'm working on, they can kind of pick up where I left off and not have any kind of dangling threads outstanding. So I think really just being intentional about building those kind of that communication fire hose so that people can tap into the information that exists, but don't necessarily have to tap on someone's shoulder to get it.
Kind of related to that, I mean, have you ever thought about opening an office someplace, or is it your intention to just kind of keep the company remote forever, or at least for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I think we're like all in on the remote side of things. The benefit for us just so far outweigh some of the challenges. And the main benefit, of course, being the people that you get to work with. You know, we've got some fantastic folks that are working with us here at Zapier that if we limited ourselves to a 30-mile radius around where we live, we just never would have an opportunity to work with them. And it just makes recruiting easier because you can recruit from anywhere instead of that 30-mile pool, which turns out anywhere is a lot bigger than 30 miles around where you live.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting contrast to how Rob built up Drip and his team, and his kind of view on it was that the hybrid model for them worked really well, where they did have an office, but they also had everybody coming into the office a couple of days a week because the collaboration opportunities and the camaraderie like really trumps that being completely remote and in different time zones. And I'm not saying that one mechanism is better than the other, but I do want to point out that it seems to me like depending on who the founders are and how they best operate and the types of people that you hire, either one can work equally well. It's really just a matter of how well you put together the team and how well everybody gels together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've had folks that we've brought in at Zapier that didn't work out, that they realized, you know, a couple months on the job, like, remote's just not going to work for me, right? Like, I just need to be around more people regularly. It's been relatively few, but it has happened. And I think that's just, you know, you as a founder, but then also, you know, you, if you're going to be going to work for somebody, has to just be honest about what's like a good work environment for you, what makes you thrive.
So along that line, I mean, what would be your advice for people who are looking to hire either remote contractors or remote employees? Are there things that they should be specifically looking for, or like traits that in those individuals, or are there specific red flags that you can think of?
Yeah, for us, the things that we really like are folks who have shown a propensity to start and finish projects kind of independently. So this could mean that they've got like a side project that they've done a pretty good job with. It could mean that at their last job, they started like a pretty new initiative and saw it through, you know, kickstarted, were the kind of the principal impactor. So just anyone that kind of just gets stuff done is a big one. We look a lot for folks who are really good at communicating through written word. So folks who aren't curt, but know how to, hey, like an exclamation point or an extra emoji or, you know, a smiley face goes a long way to kind of giving those things that you don't get, like body language, when you're writing as your principal medium. And then I think probably the last thing that's important, which can sometimes be tough to judge because of it's kind of outside of what's legally askable, but it's really nice if folks have like a social circle outside of work. You know, if they principally use work as their social outlet, it's really going to be tough in a remote setting because there's just not any people around to be that. But if they have, you know, maybe it's family or friends or a meetup group that they go to regularly, if there's, you know, a co-working coffee joint where they've got a lot of friends or something like that that they can get locally, that really helps out too.
You know, it's interesting because like that actually came up. We kind of phrased it differently. I don't think we worded it quite as well as you did. But the basic idea was that feeling of isolation and specifically looking for what somebody has going on outside of work to maintain a social life. That's a really good piece of advice, I think.
Yeah, I mean, families, like we have a ton of families at Zapier, and it seems like a lot of them get that through family. But we also have folks that don't have families and have friends or, you know, other social outlets to make it happen too.
Cool. So in terms of red flags, what are things that you would look for that say this person would probably not be a good fit for a remote working environment?
Well, that communication one is a big one. So, you know, if they feel like, hey, let's get on the phone to discuss everything, right? Now, maybe your remote environment is set up to work through the phone, but that's not how it is at Zapier. Like we do everything through Slack or some other written medium. And so if they can't communicate well in an email, or they're always like, hey, let's get on a call to discuss that. It's like, well, you know, is this what it's going to be all the time? Like, you know, you can't get on a phone call with someone who's halfway across the world very easily to discuss a thing. You got to figure out how to do it written and asynchronously. So I think that's a big one. And really, it's just, I mean, it's the opposites of some of these things, right? It's like, do they not get stuff done, right? Like, you know, you can ask them about a time they shipped a project, or if you're hiring for a customer support role, it's like, did you know, talk about the customers you supported, and you can pay attention to like, what do they think is impressive versus what do you think is impressive? You know, if they're like, I helped out 10 customers over email today. Well, for us, that's not super impressive. Like we've got folks that are doing 60, 70, 80, you know, so it's like totally different volume of work. So you can just, you know, ask those behavioral interview type questions to kind of figure out like, is this the type of person that gets stuff done, or, you know, do they tend to not be that motivated, I guess.
So when you're actually going through the process of hiring somebody, do you do phone calls with them or Skype interviews, or is it all through email?
We do both. So we have a application form that asks kind of some questions that we think will elicit responses that tell us how they will do the job, right? And then, you know, we do a follow-up phone screen that kind of makes sure they understand the role, make sure we understand who they are, and kind of get a sense for like, you know, is this a type of person that, you know, is going to be a good communicator, they're going to get stuff done, that they, you know, can empathize with other teammates, kind of some of the values that we have here at Zapier. And then we have a second interview, which is a skills test interview, where we actually have like some scenarios that we've built out that represent the work of that role at Zapier. And so we run them through that skills test. And that skills test has probably been the best addition to our hiring process because it really makes sure that folks do have the underlying skills to be successful at Zapier.
Yeah, one of the things I've encountered is that you make the process sound rather lengthy, and in reality, is it sounds like it's only about three to four steps long. But I think for somebody who's building something, you know, in their living room or from their kitchen table, that process sounds overly long and overly burdensome for them. But at the same time, if you don't go through that process, it's very easy to fall into a situation where you've made a bad hire or somebody's not going to work out, and then you spend 3 months stringing things along, and instead of just ending it and saying, okay, we need to part ways because this isn't going to work out.
Yeah. And, you know, from start to finish, it can go really fast. Like, you know, when we decide to review the applicants from the time where we're like, all right, let's schedule that first phone screen and go through that skills interview process, we've had that done start to finish in less than a week before. So it can go really, really fast if you're dedicated to making it happen.
I guess the next question I have for you is that you've established a substantial size company now. You've got 70 employees. You've got 1.5 million users. What's one of the biggest challenges you see for the business moving forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big thing is most companies don't fail because of some sort of external factor. Most of them fail because the people inside the company and likely the founders, honestly, so Brian, Mike, or myself mess something up, right? Like we do something that hurts the culture, you know, people turn against us, or we make some dumb decision that drastically affects our ability to ship a good project or ship good product, something like that. So, you know, I think I'm just like constantly paranoid about trying to make sure that Zapier is a fantastic place to work and that we're making, you know, we're bringing in high caliber folks who can kind of make sure that we are making good decisions and that we're making good forward progress and shipping things fast and all the stuff that we want.
Is that something that kind of as an executive team you guys meet and talk about, or is that just something that, you know, you guys kind of keep in mind moving forward as you make decisions about the company? I'm just wondering how much of it is keeping this in mind versus being intentional about that.
So we actually do try and do this intentionally. So once a month when the executive team, we ask two questions of each member on the executive team, which is, what is the biggest problem you and your team are having right now? And then a second follow-up question to it is, what's a problem that might pop up down the road if it's not addressed now? And honestly, that second question is way more important to me, because the problems that people talk about now are the stuff you already know about. It's like, yeah, you know, we know that that's a problem. We're working to address it, right? We're going to get that fixed up. That second one is the stuff that people haven't articulated yet. It's stuff they haven't shared. And, you know, it usually is, it's phrased such as like, hey, what's a problem that will pop up? But honestly, when they answer it, it's stuff that's already popping up now. It's, you know, they're sharing things that like, I've already seen this happen once. And so, you know, when you hear that, it's like, okay, we need to start fixing that stuff now too. So it really helps you kind of cut off the problem areas before they get like enough room to cause like a really, really big issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question to ask yourself. I mean, I have a couple of things that I have on my monthly to-do list that just kind of pops up on the first of each month. It just says, hey, look at the biggest problems you've had this past month, and then, you know, kind of review what the goals are moving forward to reevaluate things and find out if there's anything that needs to be either reprioritized or anything like that. But I think intentionally thinking about what could be a problem down the road that would almost be a business killer is probably something good to add to that list.
Yeah. And I think the combo, like asking them together, is what's really interesting, because you get kind of those things that you already know about and you already see, and then you get it contrasted against some of the stuff that maybe you don't see. And, you know, when a company gets to a certain size, like those types of questions are really helpful, especially for me. I don't have the visibility to everything at Zapier like I used to. You know, I used to do everything. So I used to know everything that goes on. And, you know, as we've grown.
Now that you're CEO, you know nothing.
Well, you know, right? Like, it's just a little tougher. You have to work harder to get like some of those insights that you just learned by, you know, almost osmosis in the past.
Right. You're a little bit more removed. There's a layer of abstraction between you and the actual problem. So you're trying to interpret things more than anything else.
Exactly. Or, you know, and it's like, oh, that is a problem. So maybe I'll actually step in and do some of that work, right? Like, oh, there's a problem in support. I'll go back and do some support, right? I've got that skill set. I can jump in and see like, okay, how is that causing problems? How can I better understand this so that we can kind of come up with a good solution here?
Cool. So I guess to wrap things up a little bit, where can people follow up with you or keep in touch with you?
Yeah. So two places, email, wade@zapier.com, and then Twitter, I'm pretty active as well, @WadeFoster. I got open DMs, so you can DM me there too.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate you coming in and talking to us and sharing the experience that you've had with Zapier.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. I'm really excited to be here.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt for Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.